Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Thanks for tuning in to Power Athlete Radio. To enter the competitive realm of shot put, some of the strongest weight room benchmarks are required. But once you've achieved that base level of strength, something else must take over. Adam Nelson is a world-class shot putter and one strong dude, but even he will tell you that chasing numbers in the gym will only distract you from the specific task at hand. Nelson puts it best when he says that lifting is like a drug, the way it makes you feel, the instant gratification, but like any stimulant, you can become dependent on it. It's only after becoming injured benching that he was exposed to rehab that improved his athleticism tenfold. This week's guest is no stranger to struggle. Hear Adam discuss how each decision he made in his career was calculated with personal integrity at the top of the list, a rare quality in a culture steeped in performance-enhancing drugs. Hear his fascinating journey to the top of track and field and his forthcoming philosophy about what can taint the success and hard work. This is episode 185.
Power Athlete Nation, what is up? Stop what you're doing and listen. Even if you're driving, stop now. It's Tex over in Texas. I love it. And you got Luke here in Southern California in a steamy 80-degree office. And we are giving you another episode of the premier podcast in strength and conditioning, Power Athlete Radio. I got an email today, Tex. Apparently, we shipped a shirt that fell apart on a guy. And it's like the bottom seam, you know. And he said they wore it twice, training it twice. Bottom seam tore up. And he's like, hey, man, can I get that returned? And, you know, I'm customer service for a shop. So I basically said no. Cut it into a crop top and fucking go out there and bang some weights. And he's like, it's forward thinking like that that makes Power Athlete Radio the premier podcast in strength and conditioning.
Is there a point here?
No. I'm just using that phrase over and over. So hopefully it embeds in people's brain and they start to believe it as much as we do.
Sorry, what did you say again?
We are the premier podcast in strength and conditioning. And thank you, Adam, for the interjection, getting us back on track. That's what our guests are for. We're honored to have Adam Nelson here, who embodies the attributes of a power athlete. He takes a heavy rock and throws it really fucking far and brings home medals to this country, America. So Adam is a shot putter and has competed in the Olympics. And, dude, we're honored to have you on, man.
Oh, I'm fired up to be on.
Beautiful. Well, how about this? In case people are living under a rock, tell them about yourself. Tell them, you know, give us either the abbreviated, the abridged or unabridged, whatever you want, baby, because it's your show.
Well, I you know, it's funny. I started throwing the shot put when I was in eighth grade after getting cut from the baseball team. And that was pretty – I didn't realize it was going to be such a big deal and have such a huge impact on my life. So But at that point, I just sort of embraced this thing that we know as power and strength sports. And that career, that sort of ride has taken me for almost 30 years now. You know, I was that weird kid in eighth grade that worked out for 2 hours every single day. We did an upper, lower, upper split Monday through Friday. We had absolutely no when I say we had no supervision, it's probably quite a little bit of an overstatement. We had no supervision of our weight room. We had a guy, a coach that was down the hall, just in case the music got too loud, he would come and say, hey guys, turn the music down. But we were largely left to our own sort of devices, if you will, in this room. And it was in that room that I really figured out who I was and, well, you know, sort of developed a passion for strength sports. Now, I probably made every single mistake in the book when it comes to lifting. At the time, but you know, the goal wasn't to go get pretty. The goal was to go get strong. And the only way we knew how to do that back in 1988 and 89 was to lift weights. We didn't have all that fancy equipment. In fact, I think, you know, We had a couple of homemade racks spot welded by some guy that worked in the machine shop or whatever.
And, nice.
The bars were all bent and the weights were all rusty and the room smelled like freaking, you know, combination of rat shit and sweat. So it wasn't a clean place, but you know, it's where you got work done. And, you know, at some point someone would introduce a new workout. Anyway, you know, it just kind of evolves from there. And I found myself going to college and have the opportunity to do both football and track in college, and wanted to do both, and had the opportunity to train with a fantastic track coach who was amazing lifting, just a wealth of knowledge, a guy named Carl Wallen. And he sort of formally exposed me to his thing called programming. Although we didn't get a chance to experience much of it because I was always working on a short season, coming off football, go right into the indoor season and then right into the outdoor season, stuff like that. Just had an opportunity that this thing that we call strength and power sports has sort of taken me from one stage to the next stage to the next stage. And I didn't really have a whole lot of expectations for anything, other than I was trying to, you know, throw this ball a little bit farther and lift a little more weight.
So I was fortunate. I was fortunate enough to hear you speak in May at Summer Strong, and you talked about that moment, that coaching that provided direction. And there was this one thing that I recall that stuck out, and it was like Dartmouth football, and you finished your football career, you finished your throwing career, but then there was a coach that said you had a chance, you had an opportunity to continue to do this post college. So I'd love to get into kind of that a little bit, because, I mean, that's a leap of faith.
It's yeah.
You get a job, but you wanted to continue the grind. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, man. It was a really interesting time in my life. I can't say that my parents always appreciated the decisions, but they supported them once they were made. So I was graduating from Dartmouth College, which is a pretty good school by most standards. And most of my friends were going on to New York to be bankers and consultants and go on to med school and stuff like that. And my college track coach, a guy named Carl Wallen, had been telling me for years, he said, Adam, like, you really have something special. You need to keep doing this. Like, you need to keep doing this. And he said it to me enough times that I finally heard it. And it was probably the right time for it too, because, you know, school was coming to an end, and I just, you know, the notion of going to New York and working 100 hours a week at a cubicle and, you know, losing all my hair when I was, it took a little while before I lost all my hair, but I would have lost it quicker, I think. But that notion, you know, didn't really resonate with me. And so when he started talking to me about it, I said, this could be really cool. And he connected me with a coach out in California that was at Stanford. And, you know, the rest is sort of history. I remember flying back to Dartmouth to pack up my stuff and drive across country. I had $200 cash to my name. Funny side note is, it took me 3.5 days to drive from New Hampshire to the Bay Area, and I was driving about 17 hours a day. And the last day I pulled into, I made it to Reno, and I just couldn't go any farther. And I'd never been to a casino before. I know that sounds kind of weird today. Like, people are like, oh, we go to casinos all the time. There's one around the corner, whatever. So I'm pulling into, I couldn't find a good hotel that wasn't part of a casino. So I pulled into the last casino on the way out of Reno called Boomtown, and had $200 cash to my name at the time, and made it up to my room, checked in, all that other stuff, came back down to see if I could find some dinner. And as I'm walking by, I said, oh, I'll try this game called blackjack. I've seen it all over. I played, you know, played some poker with some friends and things like that back then, but hadn't really played in a casino in like 5 minutes, lost down to my last $5. I was like, oh man, this is not good. So what do you do in that moment? Well, I push all in, I have $5 left, and then I go on this run, this heater for like the next 2.5 hours, and ended up winning $1,500 and paying for my first summer in the Bay Area. So it covered all my expenses, but I did live in a closet underneath the stairs for $200 a month. So it was in a house with 11 other track athletes that were all trying to make the 2000 Olympics. So, but I couldn't have done it had I not taken that leap of faith, that first leap of faith, and then maybe another one at Boomtown there.
Funded by blackjack, man, going on a heater. Nothing better than that.
Exactly. And it probably left me with unrealistic expectations every time I go to a casino now.
Yeah. Yeah. It ruins it. I've been on like one heater in the past 7 years and everything else I've, you know, paid back fucking 10 times.
There's a reason why those buildings are so nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, just living 10 track athletes to one house, you're living underneath the stairs. That takes a dedication. That takes a motivation. I mean, where did that motivation come from? Was it all intrinsic? Did you keep in touch with Carl, your coach? What was that? Because, I mean, motivation, it depletes very quickly. And what continued to kind of fuel that fire for you? Because, I mean, sleeping underneath stairs, it doesn't sound very comforting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things where misery loves comfort or company. And I was living with 10 other guys at the time. So, you know, people were all doubled up in rooms and whatnot. And they were all making sacrifices. So it didn't seem like it was anything like abnormal or unusual to me. I mean, my college buddies were all doing their thing and making good money and advancing their life careers, so to speak. But to me, the chance of making the Olympic team and representing my country and hopefully winning a medal meant more to me. And I realized that when I made that decision, I said, I'm going to do this for 3 years. I'm not going to give up. I know I'm going to face a lot of obstacles between here and there. And I don't know what those obstacles are, but I'm not going to fear the unknown. I'm going to walk into it and say, this is my mission. This is my direction. And I'm going to walk right through that blackness until I come out the other side. And, I can't say it was always easy. I definitely shot myself in the foot more than one occasion. I had injuries. I had, you know, stupid 23-year-old, 22-year-old mistakes that could have cost me even more. So glad that they didn't have cell phone videos back then.
But, you're not the first one to say that in this crew, man.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember that most of our brethren in the world of strength and conditioning are pretty much borderline outlaws most of the time. So, I don't know if I was an outlaw, but I certainly made my share of mistakes that are now well behind me. They can't resurface on any YouTube or Google moment there. So,
did anyone else in the house falter? Did they quit? Did they give up? Did that help motivate you?
Yeah, I mean, it was so this house that I stayed in was actually called, they nicknamed it the stable because it was where all these track athletes, those Olympic hopefuls, would kind of go and stay when they were in California in that area. There was a big running group called the Farm Team that trained out of Stanford, and they had some pretty good success. But the whole house, the whole thing was, it was turnover, turnover, turnover. You'd see people, I mean, this is the peak of the internet bubble, 95, 96, 97, 98, 99. And so there are all these other opportunities that are being thrown at you. And you take a job as a part-time job with some internet company, and they all of a sudden they say, hey, we're about to go public and we like you and we want to hire you. And here's 2,000 shares. And by the way, tomorrow those are going to be worth $60 a piece. People made decisions based off the short-term gains. And for me, I said good luck to you. I mean, they weren't, most of those guys were at a level where they were decent nationally, but they weren't really ranked globally. I kind of had the exact opposite. So I was actually, for any other country, I would have been number one or number two in their order. At least as a shot putter, but in the U.S. I was, you know, number six or seven. So I knew that if I could get to trials and do well there, that I would do well at the Olympics. A lot of those other guys were not in that situation, so they had a different decision to make. But once I made the decision, and this is pretty much how I am, like once I make a decision to do something and there's a long-term commitment to it, I'm not saying that I'm unwavering. Like there's definitely a time where you doubt yourself and there's definitely a time when you may have to say, this isn't the direction that I'm going to go. But you go into it with the full, you know, you go into it not looking for a half win or a half victory. You're looking for the full thing. If you asked me in 1998, whether or not I thought I was going to make the Olympic team, I would have told you I'm not living under a damn set of stairs in a freaking closet because I hope to finish second. you know, or third, or not make the team, or just want to make trials, I'm going to tell you point blank that I'm here to make the damn team. And I felt that way throughout the whole time. Like, you know, at some level, like all my peers and friends that didn't make that choice, that chose to go a more conventional right out to college, it was me against the world too. Like, you find motivation from everything. So people say, well, what are you doing? Well, you'll see. In 3 years, you'll see. Well, the odds of you doing that aren't that great. Well, the odds of you doing it aren't that great, but I'm doing it right now. So all these, there's so many people that see what you do. And especially if you have the courage to dream big and bet the ranch on things, there's so many people that are going to look at you with doubt and they're going to say, no, you can't do that. People love to project their own insecurities and their own inabilities on other people all the time, because if you were to succeed, make them look like an ass. And that's just the way I saw it. So when people said, oh, you can't do that, I'd say, no, you can't do that. I'm doing it now. And so it would fuel me. Like, whenever I heard someone say you can't, it just empowered me to push harder. And whenever I faced a challenge, like, I think the biggest challenge that I faced, you know, physically, was a pec tear in 99, tore my right pec minor, doing a last warm-up set of bench. And it was one of those situations where I found myself, like, I was in between jobs at the time and didn't know about this thing called COBRA that you're supposed to pick up after you leave a job. And so I didn't have insurance. And it was a tough, really, really tough time for me. And I went to see this first doctor, agreed to see me. He's a great doctor, one of the doctors for the 49ers. And he says, well, you've got pretty much two choices. You can have the surgery and just kiss the Olympics goodbye, or you could try rehab. And maybe in 3 to 6 months, more like 6 months, you'll be able to throw. But he's like, I doubt it. I doubt you'll be able to make it at that point. And to me, that was a no-brainer. That was another all-in situation. That was me, you know, with $5 left at Boomtown, you know, like, I'm here. I'm committed to this. If I back out now, I've got nothing. There's no win. There's no win. You know, there's only a loss. I rolled that boulder all the way to the top of the hill. And just before I made it to the top, I got hurt and the thing rolled all the way back down and I just let it go. No, that's not how I am. I want to finish the task at hand. And if I fail, I'm going to fail miserably. I'm going to fail in a huge way, but I'm not going to accept that fail. But I'm not going to accept that failure because someone thinks that, you know, just because of a circumstance that was beyond my control. If there's a way to work through that circumstance, and I'm going to do it. And that's kind of how I was then. That's kind of how I am now to a certain extent too. Like, so I did. And the best thing, the thing was, that injury was a blessing in disguise. I'd been focused so much on strength, like the way I did my strength training at the time, I was strong as crap, but it wasn't converting to great throws. And I just changed the way I got out of, I had to get out of the weight room because I couldn't stabilize. I couldn't hold anything with my upper body. And so I started, you know, getting back to the basics, the fundamentals, running and jumping and coordination stuff. And people were like, well, what did you do differently? Well, I didn't lift. I did rehab for 4 months. I did it 4 days a week, 5 days a week for 6 hours every single time I did it. And on top of that, I did some running and some jumping, and it was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. And when I came out of it, I was actually a better athlete. And ultimately, as a thrower, you know, we use the weight room as a tool to get better at throwing, not as a tool to get stronger. There's a difference between the two. And at different times in your life, you may have to focus on the strength over the actual result. But for me, at that point in my life, strength was not my limiting factor. And I didn't realize that until that element was taken away from me.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's interesting to hear the anecdote, because this is something, I don't know if we're necessarily, you know, I guess we're on our soapbox, we're beating the war drum of athleticism. Right. That is the vessel to performance, regardless of the discipline, regardless of if it's a track and field sport, racket sport, field sport, fitness, sport of fitness, things like that. But what we firmly believe and firmly train for is to improve not only our athletes' strength, power, and speed. Like, that should be kind of a given, but it's to maximize transferability of those performance traits through integrating that shit into athletic endeavors, right? The ability to effortlessly and seamlessly move through space and complete tasks known both known and unknown, right? So it's just that, like, that elevates your abilities across the board, whether it's a fine-tuned skill or just kind of like a blunt force skill, like running, you know, slamming your head with a helmet on through an opponent, you know, the more athletic version of yourself will be a higher performer, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's hard. The biggest challenge I think that most athletes face and coaches too, is the weight room is it's got the greatest feedback loop of all. Like you know that if you do work, you're going to see results, period. If you don't do work, you're not going to get the results you want. But those results, whether good or bad, don't always translate to better or worse performances. And the less that your event looks like this, you know, a bench squat, deadlift, snatch, jerk, whatever the lifts are that you value or base your training off of, the less important or the less correlation they're going to have, lower correlation they're going to have to your actual performance, what you're training for. And that's the real trick, you know, particularly with field and court sports and the team sports. That's the biggest issue is people focus on like how much they lift. Well, none of that really matters if you can't go out and play the damn game. And so, you know, the weight room is great. It gives you instant gratification and feedback, and it's a great thing for your confidence and stuff. But it's also, it's an addiction. It's a drug in and of itself. And at some point too much of that drug has not the same, it doesn't have the desired effects anymore. And so you have to constantly walk that line. And so, you know, if you're a football player and you want to get a big bench and whatever, that's great. But is it really going to help you be a better football player? Maybe if it makes you mentally stronger, okay. But, I mean, I love the bench. I love the squat. I love the deadlift. I love all of them. I love the Olympic lifts. They're fantastic. I love strongman exercises. They're all great. But I'm not training to be a great power lifter. I'm not training to be a great Olympic lifter. I'm not trained to be a strongman. I was trained to be a shot putter. And there are minimum thresholds of strength that are probably necessary to throw the shot put a certain distance. And sort of the benchmark distance is probably, 70 feet or 71 feet now. And these guys are throwing so far, it's probably higher than 70 feet now. But the strength levels don't change to throw a world record versus just 70 feet. It's a technical, it's a transferability. And that's different for everybody. This has been a real hot topic over the last 5 or 6 or 10 years. When Bondarchuk kind of came to Canada and got out of Russia and started talking and working with athletes that weren't Russians, I think a lot of people opened their eyes to the specificity of training and what that actually does. But I this is all anecdotal. Like, I haven't worked with the thousands and done the research on thousands of athletes like Bondarchuk has done. Like, that's the thing about it. But I can tell you that there is no one right way to train, and that you can produce world-class results predictably with conventional lifts. But you have to put time in on both sides. You've got to learn the technique, and you've got to learn the training, and you have to understand that there's going to be a time where you have to focus more on the transfer of that strength into the actual event. I think it's a – at that point, there's a little bit of an art and science to it, and it's going to differ based off each individual. So I don't know really where I'm going with that whole conversation.
Well, I'll steer you back. We share the same sentiments, and I know that's probably why Tex wanted to get you on here. But now, anecdotally, I guess, with your life cycle, I like to use that term, life cycle. When did you figure this out? When did you figure out, you know, at one point you had, just like all of us, you know, believe that a bigger bench is going to make me a better baller, you know, type deal. But, you have a different track than me, clearly, because I peaked in high school. I'm a state champion, but that's all I got. I mean, you've done much, much bigger things.
Text, we have a shared, text, shared experience between us. I was a state champion
too. Oh man. Tell me about your state championship. You were on the worst team in Katy, Texas. Was that Katy, Texas history? Is that what it was?
Don't worry about that. But I got 60 D3 games underneath my belt that matter. That's all that matters.
Okay, bringing it back in though. Tell me, at what point did you have that epiphany, or did you have a mentor that kept you fresh of mind to realize that, hey, listen, training is assumed, training is implied. It's like breathing. It's like drinking water. You need to hit these lifts. You need to hit move some iron. But at the end of the day, it's just a vessel to performance.
Yeah. I would say, in hindsight, it was when I got hurt in 99 that I realized that, I didn't always throw well when I was at my strongest. But I think more than anything, I realized how little or what this gap is between my perceived need for strength or whatever that perceived that minimum threshold or threshold of strength necessary to throw far is and where it actually is. And I started realizing that in 99 or 2000, 2001, sometime during that time, I started transitioning over. But the way I trained, though, I never really trained for to hit maximum strength numbers. And I know this sounds crazy, but I think, in a 30-year career of lifting, aside from when I basically maxed every time I went in the weight room when I was, in 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, outside of that, I probably did – I had to do a max for football, and that was the only time I ever maxed, ever. And everything else in my training was not based off maxes. So I always base things off of like specific rep ranges and said, okay, I'm going to work. So if I had like a set of five or something like that, or a set of five, it was like, set of 5 to 7 or a set of 6 to 8 or whatever. And I'd always shoot for the high end of the rep range. And if I hit the high end of the rep range, I'd add weight. Really simple. Didn't use any fancy periodization charts, didn't use any fancy percentages or worry about this, didn't know what the damn names were for the different periods. Like, oh, general prep, what's that? I don't know. Everything's general prep to me because we're generally preparing for life every day, right? I did it a lot more organically and I didn't really worry about the weight numbers. Now, my numbers were pretty solid, like even in high school, I didn't know what the heck I was doing, but as an eighth grader, bench was the only thing we really tested in until my senior year in high school. We did the 40 and some things like that too, but I mean, for the most part, it was bench, was what we had the wall for, we had a leaderboard there. So, I had goals, like I wanted to do 225 and then 275 and 315 and 405 and, whatnot. And I hit every one of those goals a year and a half or so early. I did 225 as an eighth grader, and I benched, I think the beginning of my ninth grade year, I did like 275 or 305 or something like that. And anyway, by the time it was the beginning of my senior year, I did 435. And I didn't max all the time at that point. I just did what I thought felt good in the weight room. And then I didn't abide by any of these rules, like don't go up more than 10% each week or anything like that. I just went whatever felt. If it felt good, I would go heavy. If it didn't feel good, I wouldn't go as heavy. And my college coach was great. So he started, working. He was a 5x5 kind of guy. But definitely spent a lot more time on kind of like building towards a peak strength and then coming down off that strength about 4 or 5 weeks before a major competition. And, I told this story at Summer Strong. Like, we started off by doing like this. It was supposed to be how did he set it up? I'm trying to remember. So he set it up so that we were going to work up to a heavy set. It didn't matter. It wasn't a heavy single. It was a heavy set of 5 or heavy 3 or whatever. And so leading up to that, I'd done 615 for 5. Week 1, week 2, I did 635 for 5. And I was in week 3 or week 4. And he's like, okay, we're going to do as many reps as possible. This whole plus set idea that – Windler and a few others and Juggernaut, those guys have popularized. So I said, okay. And we had 665 on the bar and I had a belt and wraps, and I'll just be honest. Like, if I could lift something one time, I could lift it 5 times. I always have been. I was always that way when I was younger. I'm not that way now. I've trained myself out of that. you know, I hit the first five, and he goes, two more. And so I hit two more, and the blood vessels in my eyes are starting to pop. And I'm like going crazy, you know, like just screaming. My whole team comes in. They're all yelling and screaming. And we're in this room. This room's no bigger than my office, really. Like, and I've got this ramshackle of a rack that I'm lifting in. Like, when I told this at SummerSlam, I'm like, no joke, seriously, man. This was a trifold rack. There was a steel sort of frame. And then on hinges, you had these two arms that kind of came out. And that's what I was lifting out of. And it was one of those ones that had three different levels. So trifold, tri-level. So the top level you kind of walked in and sat down onto, and then you could back out, whatever. Theoretically, I guess if you crash, you'd go into the safety bars, but whatever. And so I hit seven reps, and I'm going. He goes, three more. And I'm like, okay. And I squat down, I go again, I hit three more, and I get 10 reps. And I'm just, I think at that point, we're all kind of stupid, like, oh my God, what the hell just happened? And he goes, two more. And I'm like, my kids are in the next room, so I can't really, you know, project too loud here. They're going to think something's wrong. And I'm like,
I crashed into the back. And for the audience, that was an F you. That was a scream. He was screaming F you at the coach.
Yeah. And so when I share that story only because, like, I never tried to lift heavy weights. The heavy weights just came to me when I did things the right way. And so I see people and they have these programs are beautiful little, you know, Excel spreadsheets and blah, blah, percentages and blah, blah, blah. Well, for most of us that don't train in a box, my 70% is going to vary. My 80% is going to vary. My 90% is going to vary based off what I did the day before. And really what happened the day before, not even from a training perspective, but from a life perspective. And so you have these things and all of a sudden people are like, oh man, you're falling behind. And there's this negativity. I can tell you that, like, if I felt bad, I would stop. And I would shut that exercise down and skip it. And it used to drive my college coach crazy until he watched me train. He's like, you're doing this the right way. And then 10 years later, I had the opportunity to train with Charles Poliquin. And he said it in a different way. And he actually embraced this concept. He said, Adam, when you reach technical failure at any lift, you're finished. And there's this notion that we're being hard or tough or, you know, manly if we sort of push through the pain. Pushing through pain is very different from when you're actually doing a performance-based program. Pushing through pain is for fitness junkies that are doing it at like 30% intensity level. That's a bunch of sissies over there. You can't push, like, when you push through pain, when you're a power athlete and you're a strength athlete, if you're pushing through pain or hitting technical failure and pushing beyond that, and you're not risking, like, coming at a serious risk of injury, then you're not training at a high enough intensity level. That's the bottom line. Like, when I fail, it's catastrophic, okay? When I fail, it's catastrophic because I'm pushing myself to the brink of where humans just aren't supposed to be able to do anything, like, at that point. And so that's, like, and I don't necessarily, I mean, it's not that, I'm making it a much bigger deal than it actually is, but Charles would say, technical failure, he's like, I don't care if you miss the tempo. If you can't control it in the tempo that I've got programmed, you went too heavy too soon. You've already hit maximum motor unit recruitment for the day. You can shut it down. You will not lose an ounce of strength because you've already stimulated the muscles that we're trying to stimulate the right way or overstimulated them, and you come back the next day and you're stronger. And that's what we're trying to do. You're not trying to hit big numbers. You're trying to get stronger. And there's a very big difference. People are so focused on hitting big numbers rather than just getting stronger. Strength comes, you know, it's the ultimate reward. It's the reward you get for long-term dedication and discipline over a long period of time. You know, numbers come to those people who chase it. You know, I want to get a 400-pound bench press. I want to get a 500-pound bench press. I want to get a 700-pound squat. I want to get a 500-pound clean. Whatever the numbers is that you choose to pursue, you're focusing on that number rather than the general strength qualities. And there's a difference between the two. It may be semantic to some people, but it's something that I think has kept me relatively injury free and high performing for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, dude, spoken like a fucking world-class athlete and somebody who's battle hardened and earned the right to speak with authority. I'm curious, you know, do you find yourself in I don't know. I don't want to use debate, but maybe discussion with maybe the general population who are training enthusiasts or even younger athletes who just, you know, they can't see the forest for the trees. And if you have a strategy or method to communicate this message to us, because, you know, for Tex and I, you know, I'll speak for Tex because I always do. you know, it's comforting to hear shit that's in common thread with everything that we preach, you know? So I'm just curious if you've had that experience and you know, how those discussions go for you.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there are people that are really set in their ways. And I'll say it like this. Like, if you're young enough in your training age or in your actual age biologically, it doesn't really matter how you train. I mean, you're learning the movements. You're going to get a neurological response. You're going to get a muscular response. All you need is volume. You know, you're really just trying to get that volume under your belt. Once you achieve a certain volume, after that, if you're training for performance, which is different from fitness, you have to start thinking a little bit more about how the individual body responds rather than, you know, what the science says. You know, the science is awesome. It's a great guide. But it's the application of that science that really, promotes and builds athletics or athletes. So what I say to people when they say, well, this kid needs to do this. I mean, generally speaking, I know I'm not going to change their mind. And I don't like to play, you know, I don't like to play the card like I know more than you. I just try to set up guardrails and say, okay, you don't want to listen to me because clearly I don't know what I'm talking about. Or you know more than I do, which is why you came to me for advice anyway. But I'm going to set up these guardrails. And here's the deal. You stay in between these rails and you can do whatever you want. Now, you will never be as good as you could be if you trusted me to lead you beyond. But otherwise, you got to stay in here. So you've got to sort of adjust their expectations and their abilities downward. And if someone just wants to chase numbers, that's, you know, unless they're a power lifter or Olympic lifter. Like I said, I mean, I wasn't a power lifter or Olympic lifter. Like, I was training for a sport outside of those two. Those are great sports, by the way. Don't even mean to knock that phrase. You know, I can tell people, I usually go back to the minimum thresholds of strength and say, look, if you want to be world class, this is what's accepted as the minimum thresholds of strength. So in my event, which is definitely high on the transfer from weight room strength into the actual event, we've got some of the highest numbers necessary to be proficient in our event at a world-class level. You know, the general rule of thumb is 200 kilo bench, you know, 250 kilo-ish squat, anywhere between a 160 to 180 clean, things like that. So what I tell people is like, okay, let's shoot for these minimum thresholds of strength and see where we're at that point. Because 99% of the people that you deal with don't even have the minimum thresholds of strength anyway to be world-class. And so you can train them a different way and keep them within the guardrails and still produce some pretty good results. But it's just a long-term conversation that you have to have with people. I mean, if you told me when I was, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17 years old that a 400-pound bench press wasn't going to make me a better football player, I would tell you you're full of crap. So that reflected in my training. Like, I was going after numbers in the only way I knew how, but I was, you know, I just did it a little bit differently.
So there's a lot of places we can go from here. I'd like to kind of go back to that motivation. And a lot of people are that results-based motivated. They want just that number, and they don't see the forest through the trees, like Luke was saying. And I'm really into this book right now. It's called Drive by Dan Pink. And he compares the results-oriented versus what, Adam, you've been talking about this whole podcast, is process-oriented. And so it breaks that process-oriented into three different motivations, but it sounds like you've got a combination of all of them. First one's autonomy, the desire to direct your own life, whether that's time, technique, team, task. The second is a desire for mastery, desire to continually improve at something that matters. You look at tasks as a chance to push out your own comfort zones and allow them to stretch themselves and develop their skills and experience further. And the final is purpose. That desire to do things in service of something that's larger than yourself, and whether that's the Olympics, whether that's the team, the guys, I mean, you're training with, it sounds like that could almost bridge that gap between, you know, pulling people away from their results only mindset.
Well, I mean, so in Olympic sports, we have this thing called the Olympic struggle, the journey. And it's something that I talk about a lot. I mean, I think every athlete at a high level goes through their own struggle, their own journey, if you will. What I can tell you is that the difference between me and the guys that I train with has nothing to do with effort or ethic or desire, or even for that matter, ability to a certain extent. Some of the guys I trained with over the last 20 years have been some of the most remarkable athletes in the world. They worked harder in some ways than I ever did. They were more focused on whatever their goals were, and they were very inspirational to me as a result. What I can tell you is that no one is ever guaranteed a result. I don't care who you are. You know, I don't really care who you are. The fact of the matter is that, there's Michigan should have whooped App State a few years ago. It was all but a guaranteed result, but App State won, you know. There's always a David and Goliath aspect. There's always an exception. So the only thing I know that I was guaranteed in this life was the struggle. And the athletes that I know that are great, the great athletes, they dominate that struggle. Everything that comes their way, whether it's a negative or a positive, they treat it, they own it, and they use it as motivation and a source for power. If you're one of those people who's always going to be a victim in life, then greatness isn't going to come your way. And greatness never comes anyway. Greatness is something that's earned. And it's earned on a daily basis. It's earned through embracing this struggle and taking ownership of this struggle and never, ever letting the struggle dictate the terms to you. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't fully understand. I remember having this conversation with these two throwers in 2002 or three. We were at a bar in Estonia after a track meet there. Sounds like a bad joke. They were young throwers, and they said to me, well, what are you guys thinking about doing? Where are you going next? What's next door? What's next for y'all? Well, we can't keep throwing. And I said, why not? And they said, we're not on scholarship anymore, and there's just no financial opportunities that support throwers, and we don't have a sponsorship. And they weren't even looking to me for advice. They were looking for me for empathy. And I just said, you guys are a bunch of pussies. And I called them point blank. I said, look, guys, you're right. It's a good time for you to quit, because you do not have the resolve. You do not have the mental toughness. You do not have whatever it is to be great. And you've clearly accepted that you will not be great, that you don't want to accept this challenge. The challenge, the rules don't change. And yeah, there's definitely some people who get a leg up on you. They get a better contract. They get a contract. And I'm not saying that I'm tougher than any of these guys. I just wanted it more. I was in a different scenario, and I don't want to say that it was me against the world. I have a very supporting family. My parents, every decision I made, they may not have agreed with it, but they supported it once it was made. And I couldn't have done anything without their support, both from an emotional standpoint and at times a financial standpoint. That was the gift that they were able to give me. But I'll say this, that there are a lot of people that want to look to make excuses. And if you want an excuse, there's 1,000 valid ones. They're real excuses. And there are real reasons for not doing something, but there's only one reason to do it. And in my event, it's because you love it. You want to do it. There's no money. I mean, I fucking threw the shot put for a living. Yeah. If I won world championships, I did okay. I did more than okay. I did great. But if I didn't, it was feast or famine. While I'm a gambling man, from time to time, I'm not stupid. And I know that in a winner-take-all scenario, there's going to be times where I'm going to come up on the short end of the stick. And when you come up on the short end of the stick, you don't look around and assign blame. You take ownership of the result. And you look back at the process and say, okay, how could I change this? How could I have made this better? Shit, I did that when I won, too. So it's the same thing for me. So going back to your original thing, like, and sort of getting back on point here is, you know, in life, you're not guaranteed a result. All you're guaranteed is the shit that happens to you every single day. And you can let that stuff dictate, you know, where you're going to be. You can be a victim to it. You can, whatever it is. Or you can take ownership of it and say, this is the hand that I was dealt. I'm going to play it better than anybody else has ever played this hand. And when the time comes and I get a better hand, I'm going to keep playing it better and better and better and better. And I'm going to learn and I'm going to grow and I'm not going to take no for an answer. I cannot tell you how many experts, freaking coaches, in 99, they told me I had no chance, no chance, no chance. Your technique is horrible. You'll never throw far that way. 97, 98, 99, all that. And the thing is, like, they hadn't seen my practices. They'd only seen a competition here or there. They didn't understand that I was really 2 or 3 years into doing this full time, you know, splitting a coming off football and coming in with injuries and having basically 3 months to train. It's like a high school athlete. Yet I was still competing with the guys at the world class and national class level. And so they'd say, your technique sucks. Your technique sucks. But I was committed to it. And my coaches were committed to it. The ones that saw me and saw me train every day, they said, wow, there's some real potential here. Let's see where he can go with it. The very next year in 2000, when I made my big, you know, breakthrough, my overnight success, those same coaches came to me and said, man, I've always loved your technique. That's crap. You're such a freaking fair weather, like, just jump on the bandwagon and go shove something up your, anyway. So, you know, I'm kind of all over here, all over the place here. I go off on a rift and just kind of go wherever it takes me. So the only thing I know that I've ever been guaranteed is just the struggle. And I love the struggle. If I'm not consumed and absorbed by the struggle, I'm bored. I'm going, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to me? Something bad's about to happen. I'm not busy enough. I'm not working hard enough. Something's going on. So you just got to love that struggle. And if you love that struggle, it's going to open up other doors. If the end goal doesn't happen, like, you know, I wanted to make the Olympic team, but if that didn't happen, I knew that by going in, jumping in headfirst into this struggle, that it was going to open up other doors one way or the other. Because so few people are willing to just throw it out there and put it all on the line and say, this is who I am. This is what I want. This is where I'm going to go. And this is what I'm going to get. All I know is that there are a few people in this world that are willing to say, this is my goal. This is what I'm prepared to do to get there. And this is how I'm going to get there. There are a lot of people out there that talk about all these things they want to do. I want to do this. I want to do that. Those are what we call hopefuls. Those are what we call hopefuls. I call those hopefuls. There's a ton of Olympic hopefuls out there. There's a lot of people that say, oh, I'm going to make the Olympic team in 2020. Okay. Show me. What are you going to do today about it? And so I sometimes talk about the difference between hope and faith. And, you know, I became a faithful when I moved out to California. And I took those first steps. Like, faith is hope put into action, as they say. And I think that's, you have to have faith to deal with that struggle. So anyway, I've kind of been all over the place there. So maybe we'll move on.
No, those two terms are great. Hopefuls versus faithfuls. It's amazing. So I'd like to kind of stick with the passion. So I know you spoke a little bit at Summer Strong about, doping in sports, and then you were part of a documentary recently. So if you could kind of talk about, I guess, your perspective from, you know, earning everything and what you've seen gone on, and then I guess about the documentary.
Yeah, and so this is a really interesting subject, doping in sports. And, you know, it seems like for a lot of people it's black and white. And for me, probably when I was younger, it was more black and white than it is today. And that's has nothing to do with that my opinions have necessarily changed on it. It has more to do with the exposure that I've had to other athletes who don't have the same sort of rules that the Olympic sports abide to. So anyway, let me back up. I think that, like a lot of people will say in a very gross generalization, drugs are bad. And they work. And there are definitely, you know, people that will tell you that this is the only way you can do this. I had a conversation with my dad when I was 16 years old. I was training at a gym in Atlanta. I remember I was doing incline press, and I was, like I said, I was a pretty strong kid, and I think I had 225 on, and I was doing it, and I struggled on my fourth or fifth rep, and some guy came over and said something to me, and it was essentially a proposition for drugs. He said, well, I've got something that can help you get that. And I remember talking to my dad about it. And my dad basically pulled me aside and said, son, if you do the things, if you take the path that it looks like you're going to take, whether it's football or track and field, this is going to be a constant in your life. And I can tell you this, that if you make a decision to do drugs, I will disown you. And I love my dad, and I know exactly what he meant. He meant exactly what he said. He will disown me. And so at that moment, I promised my dad that I would never do drugs, performance enhancing drugs. I may have smoked dope once or twice in my life. But not proud of it.
Shit happens.
But it's been a while.
You know, like you said, you're running with all those outlaws, you know?
Yeah.
Those outlaw strength, you know, people in the iron game.
So I promised him that when I was 16 years old, and we had this frank discussion about it. And I just said, look, it's not worth it to me to, one, risk my health, and two, risk my integrity to do this. And it was not something that I had to worry about in my community in high school. It wasn't really an issue there. And then in college, I was kind of sheltered. You know, there's not a huge performance enhancing drug issue at Dartmouth. You know, that's just not where the kids are. But when I moved out to California, I remember this is the first time that I'd actually been approached by it. And I got there was a guy named Greg Trefalis, who's a shot putter out there. And he introduced me to this other guy at a track meet. And the guy says, oh, we're doing great things. You got to come over to our lab, and we'll do our blood test, and you'll do all those other things, and we'll get a great profile on you. And, you know, it didn't help that Greg is now, I think, on a lifetime ban. He's actually a great guy. He's one of those guys that said you couldn't throw farther than 20 meters clean. And I told him, no, you couldn't throw farther than 20 meters clean. He used to get mad at me for saying that. But he introduced me to this guy, and I can remember the name. Man, that guy was just really sketchy. And it turned out that was the guy who was the head of the Bay Area lab company, Balco. So I never, you know, had I not had those conversations with my dad when I was young, I don't know if I would have had the moral compass to avoid people like that. And, you know, I think I've seen steroids three times, or had those types of incidences three times in my 30-year career, but I didn't seek out people that had those kinds of, you know, relationships with drugs, if you will. So I guess I just either actively avoided it, or the people that I hung out with just didn't, I got lucky. I can tell you this, like, to me, doping is, for a lot of these athletes, to me, it's kind of like when you're in school and that really smart kid who is totally insecure decides they're going to cheat on a test, even though they've got 100 average. It's like, what the hell are you doing? I've always felt that I was capable of doing much more. And so I took it as a personal challenge. And I can remember the website, bodybuilding.com, used to make these t-shirts. I actually bumped into the guys not too long ago, but they used to have this t-shirt that said, no, I'm not on steroids, but thanks for asking. It was a classic. I don't know why.
Perfect, man.
You know, I prided myself on that stuff. And I remember when I first came in to the Olympics board, like, okay, I had a 5 foot PR in 1 year, and people are like, they're freaking out. Like, what's he on? I'm like, man, I don't know why these people are saying this stuff, because like, I've been throwing this far in practice and just haven't been able to do it in a meet and you know, all this other stuff. And then the worst was that they would say it behind your back and then come to you afterwards and say, oh yeah, good job. And then you'd find out that they were just, you know, crapping on you behind you when you weren't looking or when you weren't listening. And I can remember having conversations with people about that. I've never really cared, you know, for people's opinions about, you know, how I train or don't train. It doesn't really bother me. But what I can't stand is people who are just two-faced and hypocritical. You know, they'll sit there and say, oh, we love you, we love you, we love you. But then behind your back, they're undermining and discrediting everything you've ever done. And I took that really personally when I was younger. I kind of grew out of that and just realized that's people's own insecurity. It's the same people that says you can't. You know, when you dream big and you bet the ranch and you accomplish some of those goals, there's always a number of people out there who say you can't, you can't, you can't, and they're projecting their own insecurities out on you. So as I've gotten older, I've kind of adapted a different approach to it. So when people say you're on drugs, I say, thanks, man. That's a huge compliment because clearly I can do things that you don't think are possible. It's funny, like I've actually almost gotten in fights with people over that. I was in a bar and I go to a lot of bars apparently. I was at a bar in Finland in 2004 or five. And I remember one of the guys at the bar was a weight class strong man. I don't know what weight, it was one of the lighter weight classes. And he was going, what do you eat? What do you eat? I said, I'm not following you here. He got so angry with me. It took me a minute to understand that he was actually talking about drugs. And he, you know, basically just, I thought he was, honestly, I was like, crap, this is going to be one of those nights where I'm going to have to fight my way to the door. And he was a big dude. But it didn't, you know, people always, when people see other people doing things that they can't do, particularly in sports, the first instinct for a lot of these people is to say, what is this guy doing that I'm not doing? It's not, wow, that could just be an exceptional athlete or an exceptional person. Wow, they really could be that much better than I am. Is it possible? So when it comes to doping in sports, like, one, I just don't agree with it. I think that you have to, like, it's, we're not trying to figure out who's got the best doctors out there, you know? And that's really what dopers are. They're a medical experiment. And it's disheartening to me that in some ways I feel like people have grown more accepting of doping in sports. You know, the good news is that the drug testing, I think, is actually closing the loop a little bit. They're closing that lag, that little, I think they're getting better with it. Certainly for my, you know, in my sport, it doesn't make sense financially. I'm not going to lie. If you need any other reason, it doesn't make sense financially because the stuff that you would take, I think, as a shot putter, the shadow would be so dark and so long that you're going to get caught. I mean, it's not rocket science on our side. Now, some of these endurance athletes are taking, the stuff is a lot more challenging to detect to begin with, but maybe there's some gene doping that's coming down. Who knows? But unfortunately, I think that doping is always going to be, there's always going to be people that want to dope, that want to cheat. And they'll justify it as saying, you know, I'm just trying to see what the limits of human ability is.
Well, don't you think it's also just, it's pairing the will and desire and passion to be the best, right? But with an individual who would be willing to die for the cause, so to speak, you know what I mean? Much like yourself, but at an early point in their life, didn't get that small parity that allows them to be guided on that subject. Right. Yeah. So imagine back, you know, you and your pop have that same discussion. He's like, yeah, fuck it. Try it out. Where would you be today? Who fucking knows? And I'm not, you know, not justifying it, but you know, you deal with a certain population that are striving for world-class performance and really willing to do anything. When you throw that opportunity in the mix, it really doesn't surprise me that people jump, you know? And one thing, just to go ahead a little step further, and you know, John, who's not here, he played 10 years in the NFL, and he talks to us ad nauseum about some of this stuff. And it's pretty funny. You know, one of the things he says, he's like, Tex, maybe help me out here, cause I'm going to probably fucking butcher it. But he's like, all I've seen steroids do is make shitty players stronger, shitty players. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's a little more to it between the ears. You know, whether it's, you know, you get to a highly technical sport, like you were saying, like, listen, it's going to allow you to recover. It's going to allow you to pack in training, probably get you bigger, stronger, faster, powerful, right? But there's an element to the, what we talked about earlier, 20, 30 minutes ago about, you know, connecting the wires between what you're doing in the weight room and then your ability to execute. So I'm sorry to cut you off, but
no, it's totally true.
I'll pass the baton to you, man. And you know, let me know your thoughts.
No, I agree. you know, I've never believed that steroids or more strength, would make a good athlete great. I think it can make great athletes pretty remarkable, but you got to have that genetic sort of disposition makeup to begin with. I think that the difference, you know, particularly in field and court sports where the disciplines are a little bit more organic and not quite so rigid, but in more form-based sports like throwing the shot put and Olympic lifting and powerlifting and such, you know, we look a lot more like the basic movements that we train in the weight room. So there's probably a higher transfer to performance there. You know, let alone like, I mean, when it comes to, especially like specificity. So the concept of specificity and how it's actually applied in the throwing world is to basically take the motion of throwing and throw thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of reps. My experience and exposure to specificity is very limited in its pure form, but I know it would break me. Okay, because my body, just the way I throw and the way that the training is, I was the exact opposite on the spectrum as far as like volume of throwing versus everything else. So I spent a lot more time in a general preparation period and would usually only throw 3 or 4 days a week for really I'd take probably 8 to 12 full throws in a session. And I tell people that that's the exact opposite of the spectrum than someone who practices specificity. You know, they'll go out and they'll take, you know, 100 throws or 50 throws in a session, and then their lifting will be more or less another throwing session and get another 1,000 reps in that way. And I get the argument behind it. I think it's, you know, pretty awesome. But if you're doing steroids and you're actually able to do that, I think you will probably see a better transfer, probably much better than whatever I got out of the weight room into the actual throwing events. I don't think just getting stronger in the weight room is going to make you a better thrower. I don't think that just getting stronger in the weight room is going to make you a better football player. Does it hurt? Probably not. But you know, at the end of the day, I look around and I know that there were athletes that were cheating when I was, you know, certainly in my prime, and I'm sure there's still athletes that are cheating now. I don't think it's as prevalent as it used to be. But none of them could beat me. And I never felt like they were throwing distances that I couldn't throw.
Right.
And maybe things would have changed had I felt like everybody who was beating me was on drugs. You know, the irony is that the guy that, you know, beats me in the 2004 Olympics ends up testing positive 8 years later, and I actually win the gold medal there. But even still, in every scenario from 2000 to 2007, I was second or better at every major championship. You know, continue to have world leading marks well into my 30s. Like I think so many people like the difference between, I guess I like it, I put it like this too. Like when people make the decision to take drugs, they're looking for a shortcut. And it may expedite their path to the top. It may. It may actually, you know, end up in and then pushing it too fast on any one day and having a catastrophic injury. I've seen that.
Right.
But I've always felt like if you do this the right way and you take the time and you've got the raw genetic material to do it. Like, you know, I was never going to be a basketball player. I'm 6 feet tall. Okay. And I'm a good jumper, but I can't shoot for a damn. Can't shoot to save my life. But I was never going to be a basketball player. Okay. My eighth grade baseball coach told me I was never going to be a great baseball player. Point blank. He said, you're going to suck. And that's why I quit baseball, or why I actually didn't get the opportunity to play baseball. I went up for track after that. So, you know, if you take the long-term approach and you do everything right, I think you can put the building blocks in place so that you can have this really strong foundation and really accomplish some pretty high highs. But at the end, I think there also, you at some level, you also have to have a dose of reality and understand that there are people that are just better than you. I referenced Christian Cantwell earlier. Christian is 6'4", 350 pounds, and he is probably the only person I've ever seen who has a natural bench press of 700 pounds. Massively strong guy. If he ever learned how to throw right, he would kill everybody. And he was a great thrower, is a great thrower, world champion. But I look at his physical abilities and his size and his strength, and I say, that's a guy who should be breaking the world record every single time he touches the ball. Like, it shouldn't even be a, it should just be, that was 78 feet, no problem. You know, and I look at some of these other guys and think the same thing. You know, that's just not the case. So strength is not always everything it's cracked up to be. But it is totally gratifying. Yeah. The strongest guy in the weight room, let's be honest.
Yeah, totally. To
the radio.
We all love getting under a heavy bar.
Yeah.
Text, before you go, it doesn't surprise me, Adam, that, like, you know, just going back to, I kind of relate to you where it's like, where there is no grind and there is no struggle, it's really hard to get engaged, whether that's on the physical side, even with business. You know, for me personally, I think we share the same sentiments where it's like, you know, sometimes John will hit me up. He's like, dude, we got to fucking – something just came up. It's going to be like a fucking 30-hour work day. And I'm like, oh, let's go, you know, let's get some coffee and let's do this. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't surprise me too that like a guy like you would take such a firm stance on the shortcut concept, because it's like, no, motherfucker, like strap yourself in and let's go and let's grind. Because if you do it right and you have the right guidance and you can put in the work and the work effort, mm-hmm. like the payoff is going to be so much sweeter when you do it, you know, it, like you said, inbounds type of deal. And it's just, and I'm just kind of pontificating, Tex. I don't know if you want to jump on that or go.
That's right in line with my next comment, is something we talk about a lot, and that's pride versus ego. It's okay to have kind of a pride, a swagger, because you understand the investment that you're putting forth towards your goal, versus an ego where you're going to let the guy who's, you know, a few more pounds stronger than you, or throwing a couple more inches farther than you, get underneath your skin and look for that shortcut. So it's you can hear kind of the passion and the pride in your process and your grind. And I mean, just out in the world of strength and conditioning, we run into a lot of the opposite, the ego, the shortcuts. And before the podcast, we were talking about, there are no shortcuts in training. It's the fundamentals, and you never lose those. Maybe I'm pontificating now, Luke. You got me just fucking storytelling here. But
it's riveting, Tex. I mean, you're doing great. Just keep going. I think – let me wake Adam up. Adam, wake up, buddy.
So the documentary, you're going down to Austin tomorrow to come. Tell us what's the title? How do we watch it? And kind of what part are you playing down there?
Well, I mean, the documentary is called Doped, and it was put together by a guy named Andrew Moscato, who really wanted to sort of delve into really the impact of doping in sport and how they're trying to detect it and whether or not the anti-doping agencies are doing a good job. It's been out there for a while. You can probably find it online someplace. It's been aired a couple of times already on TV. But they're just doing a showing at the University of Texas tomorrow. I think Thursday night at 7. Some I can find the details for you, but they're doing a panel to sort of with a bunch of, I guess, experts from different sides, a couple of journalists, a couple of scientists, and myself. We'll get together and kind of talk about doping and our perception of doping in the sport, and our experiences. I mean, my experiences with doping in the sport have been, you know, it's actually been horrible, to be quite honest. Like, and, you know, I started training as an Olympic athlete to make an Olympic team and hopefully win a gold medal. And, I didn't care about the money. I didn't care about the fame. I didn't care about any of that other stuff, because to me at that time, that's not what the Olympics was about. It was a career, and it was my profession for a long time. So there is a balance, a fine line between the two. But ultimately, the things that I lost were the things that I started doing the whole sport for. I never had the memory of hearing my national anthem played at an Olympic Games and getting that gold medal in front of my family and my friends and representing my country like that. And I know that sounds, a lot of people think that, oh, well, that's just a little bit cheesy and this and that, but that's why I started doing the damn thing in the first place. I didn't start throwing the shot put because, I guess at some level I enjoyed the personal challenge, but I started throwing the shot put because it's part of track and field, which is an Olympic sport. And I thought, well, hey, you know, at some point maybe this will be something that'll take me to another level. Although I didn't really start thinking that until after college, but you know, that's why I made the move to California. That's why I was willing to sacrifice my career, professional career outside of sports. And it's given me so much, but it's taken away so much. From a financial standpoint, it did cost me a lot of money. We don't make a lot of money as shot putters, and the only time you do actually have a chance to make money is in that moment when everybody's watching and you win the day. And that happens once every 4 years. And I was never able to get back into that situation where I was healthy again. 8 years later, I get a phone call saying, oh, you know, we did a test of 100 samples, 100 athletes from the Greek Olympics, and 5 of them tested positive, and it looks like one of them's a shot putter. And that wasn't even from an official with the Olympic movement. That was from a reporter. And then I get another call after the 2012 Olympics saying, hey, have you heard anything? And it's the same reporter. I said, no, have you? And she said, yeah, they're supposed to meet. The IOC is supposed to meet to figure out if they're going to vacate the spots or reorder.
So Adam, when she broke the news to you the first time, like, dude, what did the phone disintegrate as you smashed it? Or, you know, what was the fucking, like, talk me through it, man.
Let me tell you something, man. Like, you guys kind of get a little taste of it on this phone call or this podcast, but like, I'm a very emotional guy when I start talking about things that I'm passionate about. Certainly with throwing, it's meant so much to me. And that particular, I mean, what you don't understand is that when I got second in 2004 at the moment, the next 8 years of my life changed. It changed my whole trajectory. I'm not saying I would have retired from sport after 2004 had I won at the moment, but I lost my sponsor, which is not a big deal. It was a big deal. It was the only guaranteed income I could have. I won a world championship the next year without a sponsor, continued to train without a sponsor for 2 years, 2.5 years. Made some things that I did some things to try to draw attention to my event and was labeled an outlaw, if you will, someone who complains and, you know, doesn't really care about the whole sport, is only self-centered. And to that point, that's totally true. Like, I was trying to draw attention and make myself relevant. I competed in a t-shirt that said, at least my mom loves me, Space for Rent, you know, trying to draw attention, doing whatever I could to draw attention to the fact that, like, hey, I need some help here. And officials in the sport, you know, the big muckety mucks would say, oh, we love what you're doing. We wish you could help you. Well, you're in a position to help me. I never felt like I was entitled to anything, so you don't hear me complain about it. But to know that I went through all that and I probably wasn't the best person. You know, I'm married to an amazing woman and she carried me through a lot of those times. And I can't say that I was always positive. And, you know, I don't think I was a bad person, but I certainly wasn't living up to my own standards at times. As I dealt with those, some of the demons that I could usually channel in a positive way. And then when you hear that, you get that conversation, you have that call and they say, well, look, everything that you worked through for the last 8 years of your life should have been different. And the reason why it wasn't was because they failed. Not me. Those people, the organizations that are supposed to protect me, they're supposed to protect the integrity of my results. They failed. Great. I'll give you a pat on the back for sticking around and staying true for 8 years. That's awesome. But that changed my life that day. And I think ultimately it's for the better. Since that time, like it opened up all those old wounds, those old wounds of like, wow, you know, you don't have regrets, but you look back and you think, okay, what did I really lose out on? And that conversation is not a positive conversation at all. And when you're looking backwards, you're not looking forwards, and that's just not a good place for me to be. I've never been that kind of person, and it challenged me in a way that was very, very hard. You know, it took me a year before I got my medal. I got my medal in a fucking food court at the Atlanta airport. A joke and say at least I got a side of fries with it.
Silver lining.
What's that?
A silver lining, right?
Yeah, right, right. You know, it to me, I mean, that's what my life's purpose was. And to have it marginalized and disrespected in that manner, maybe a real bitter person for a long time. And I'm pretty good at keeping those types of feelings inside, but it was not an easy time. And then I was transitioning at the same time too. So I was transitioning out of sport, which is not always easy. And, you know, it's funny. I thought I had this whole transition thing all lined up. Like I consider myself a reasonably bright guy. I went to a great undergraduate school at Dartmouth, and then in 2006 enrolled at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business and graduated there in 2008. But I guess I made choices that devalue those experiences, at least in the short term, because you continue to pursue things that have nothing to do with your academic experience. And all that sort of hit home at that moment. So I was very angry. That's the short version. I was very, very angry. I hated everybody. You know, I hated the IOC. I hated the Olympics. I hated USA Track and Field. I hated WADA. I hated USADA. All those people let me down. And for the first time in my life, I found myself feeling like I was owed something. And I don't think that's a healthy place. And when I finally got over that, I just said, look, this is who I am. This is where I'm going. And I suppose at some level, I can be the gold medalist for the rest of my life. And so I have to sort of hang my hat on that. But at the end of the day, like it really challenged who I was as a person. And to a lot of people, you know, outside of sports, they're like, it's just you're a gold medalist. That's awesome. But medals don't really mean much to me, to be quite honest. They validate the struggle. That's all they do. They're a physical representation of how well you conquered the struggle. And I guess I feel like I got a medal for good behavior. I got a medal because I did it the right way. And that's the value there. But it took me a long time to work through that. And like I said, I'm lucky. I've got a great family who supported me, and I've got a wife that kicked my ass when she needed to. And anyway, it doesn't change the way I feel about the struggle. I still love it. I still love this little thing that we call strength and conditioning and power sports. And I still love the shot put, and I still at some level love the Olympic movement, but I see it for what it really is. But I still hope I can inspire people to do it the right way and let my demons die where they need to die.
Yeah. And you know, I think just your involvement and for example, the documentary, and I'm sure that this, you being a very driven and passionate individual, you can channel your energy in kind of the disappointing situation you were put into. You can channel that to clean the shit up, you know what I mean? And help and at least contribute to that. So in the long term, you know, not only are you gold medalist, but you help push the movement into getting better testing into the Olympics and the Olympic Committee and making sure that no one has to go through the shitty deck of cards that you were dealt because some asshole decided to take a shortcut, right? And yeah. And the people who were supposed to detect that didn't. Now, right, wrong, you know, whether it was nefarious and clandestine cheating tactics or who knows, right? Or maybe it was just shitty technology. Like, I think that, you know, first step is getting this information out there. And it sounds like that's what you guys are doing with the documentary.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying to do. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we've got to have an open dialogue about drugs and sport. And it's like, I mean, honestly, it's no different than I feel like the country is going through right now. Like, you have to have a conversation about things that, like, you know, on either side could make someone look like or feel defensive. I come out and I say, look, I don't think you can do, like, you don't need to do drugs to be a world-class athlete. And the people that do drugs are like, this guy's full of crap. You don't know what you're talking about. You blah, blah, blah. Well, actually I do know what I'm talking about. I've done it the right way. And I'm not saying I'm better than you, but I actually am because I'm not cheating. I can help you learn and hopefully, but I can't do this unless we engage in dialogue. And I feel like the thing that's missing from the doping control or anti-doping movement right now is really engaging the athletes. And you brought up football, and John has a football background, and the football players, NFL guys that I've talked to, you know, they know that there are some people that cheat. They know that some people are doing drugs in the league. But the guys that I've talked to have said, look, when we find out someone's doing stuff, we just shame them to just there's no end in the locker room. We're talking, you know, we're making fun of them in every single possible way you can possibly imagine. We're shaming them. So while we don't necessarily have the best drug testing, we've got a culture that really doesn't support it or allow for it, either by turning a blind eye or by actually, you know, supporting it. So, and that's where I think the Olympic sports have failed is, you know, we've, as athletes and coaches, we've deferred all that responsibility to the testing agencies and have turned a blind eye to everything else. And they want that. They want us to have no input, to have no say. And that's got to change.
Nice, man. That's some heavy shit. Tex, did you have anything else?
Well, we talked about two opportunities that you wanted to kind of present to the crowd. And this could be way of letting them know of, hey, there's some good direction here. You're putting out a book, and then you got Legends of Strength.
Yeah, man. Well, actually, I got a bunch of stuff going on. I'm fired up more than anything about all this stuff. Like, I'm starting to understand kind of how great a tool this thing is called the internet. It's better for – I'm going to stop right there. I'm working with a guy named Kevin McMahon. He's a two-time Olympic hammer thrower, and he's a great design guy. He's designed a couple logos for me in the past, and we got this idea for something called Legends of Strength, which is just basically a website that allows people to post their best, you know, feats of strength of the week, whether it's in their training venue or, and it doesn't really have to be anything specific. Like I always say, it's like, look, what's a great feat of strength? Like, is it the guy that 95-year-old guy that goes out and runs 100 meters in, you know, 20 seconds, or some guy who's, you know, pulling 700 pounds from the floor? Like, that's all, both of them have their own merits. And so we're trying to create this, this space where we can just sort of allow people who love power and strength to share in an open community. I hope it, you know, we'll see where it goes. I think it's a pretty cool concept right now. And we're still working on that. There should be a, it's still in the beta phase right now. So the Legends of Strength site's not up in a publicly digestible format yet, but hopefully it'll come out soon. And then I've got a book that I've written, a workout book that talks about my approach to training. It's a approach that combines sort of my key influencers from my high school and college coaches to guys like Charles Poliquin and Judd Logan and a bunch of other guys that probably are more better known in the throwing world. But I'm really fired up about that. It's a 3-month training program. I've actually been working through it for the last like 2 or 3 months, now 2.5 months now. And, just to make sure that I like it a lot. And it's based off all the kind of training that I would do in a general prep period. And I think it's going to be a great resource for power and strength athletes, to just draw upon. I'm a huge fan of eccentric loading and eccentric training. And I delve into that quite a bit, in this workout. Not to toot my own horn, but I'm feeling pretty good right now. And then I've got this constant sort of passion project that I've been working on for a long time called Strong at 40. I'm 41 now. And I feel like so many people in this day and age are looking to be high performers, for the rest of their lives, you know, not just when the formal competitive opportunities stop, but well into their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And I think a fundamental part of that is staying strong in a smart way in the weight room. So I've got a bunch of little projects that I'm working on, and I'm pretty fired up about all of them.
Well, that's good, man. We're kind of coming up to that end point. If anyone wants to check it out, where do you want to point them? You got a social media platform? You want to send them to a website, or which one?
Yeah, right now I'd probably put them to either like my Instagram. Still working on my websites there, but the Instagram, which is AdamNelson5376. I don't know why I did that. I didn't realize what it was when I signed up for it. And
there's 5,375 other Adam Nelsons, right?
I guess so. I thought about changing it over. I think I could probably change it over to match my Twitter handle, which is Adam Mick Nelson. That's my Adam Mick Nelson for Twitter. But those are the two best places, I think, right now. I'm not really quite proud of what the website is right now. But when the websites are ready for public digestion, you guys will be some of the first to know.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, Adam, dude, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for sharing the story. Like I said before, man, you embody the power athlete mentality and the performance side of things. It's awesome to be aligned with a guy like you. You know what I mean?
Thanks, man. I love what you guys are doing here with the podcast. Keep it up.
Oh, you got it, bro. No problem. It is, I don't know if you know this, it's the premier podcast in strength and conditioning.
So let me get this straight. This is the premier broadcast in strength and conditioning?
No, podcast.
Podcast.
I kind of like broadcast better.
There you go. Premier podcast broadcast in strength and conditioning. I love it.
Ooh, the broadcast podcast. We should start that text.
There you go.
It's like the Wadcast podcast, but it's the broadcast podcast. So we can talk about literally anything we want.
That's what broadcast means?
I'm broadcasting that fact right now. All right, guys, let's wrap it up, man. Thanks again. And Tex, I'll see you on the other side, bro. Safe travels. I know you're going to Sweden.
Yep. All right. Yeah, Adam, thank you. Thank you for taking the time, man. I know you got a lot going on, busy man, and it was awesome. I got a lot of notes. Got a lot of notes here. So some doodling, but it's all good.
All right, guys. Thanks so much, guys.
All right. See you later, man.
Thank you.
Now it's time for you to empower your performance. If you were blown away by Adam Nelson's mindset and training philosophy like I was, get to following him on Instagram at AdamNelson5376 or Twitter at Adam McNelson. And keep your eyes peeled for his Feats of Strength website. With Festivus just around the corner, I may just have to submit my own. And a very special shout out to anyone who attended the 2016 Power Athlete Symposium, particularly all of our amazing guest speakers. Minds were blown all weekend long. Until next time, bye!
Hey,
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply, in-app only.